Good morning, brothers and sisters. How are you? Doing well? We've been in a series for a few weeks called Rescuing Jesus. The idea is that the real Jesus has been lost. Jesus' character, his name, it's been lost. It's been obscured, in large part with religion, with creeds, and with a mentality that turns the faith in Jesus, following Jesus, into a set of static beliefs, statements to be agreed with or denied. The Apostles' Creed, we've come to this a couple times in the last few weeks. Many of us, we memorized the Apostles' Creed. And it has this part where it says that he was conceived by the power of the Holy Spirit, born of the Virgin Mary, suffered under Pontius Pilate. That's the flow of it. That's how it goes. And those are deeply significant moments, theological truths. There's some sacred stuff there, his birth and his death. But interestingly, it skips everything in between, his birth and his death, his life, who he was. We've turned Jesus into a position. We've turned his life into moments that we use to measure the spirituality and the faith of other people. But what about his life, his teaching? His teaching is how to live in the very real world. This whole mentality has the negative side effect of reducing what God sent his son to do into a belief statement, into a position that has to do with the other realm, the spiritual. It's good for if you happen to be talking about this thing over here, some spiritual thing. But it doesn't seem to address our very real life. The one we actually care about. Our day-to-day existence. We need somebody to speak into that. Well, Jesus did for 33 years, over three decades, taught us how to live our lives, loving God with all we have, heart, soul, mind, and strength, and loving our neighbor as self. So that's the Jesus that we want to rescue from our religion and our creeds, the real Jesus. And some of these thoughts today were already planned a couple weeks ago that we would talk about this particular aspect of Jesus. But a lot of it is in just response to what's going on in the world. And so today is kind of everywhere. Yes, it's one of those. It looks more like a mosaic, because that's just kind of where our heads are. Well, there are things that we're really confident about, and then things have just—it's got us pulled in all these different directions, and it's confusing, and it's blurry, and it's kind of hodgepodge in our minds. And so today we're going to talk about that. In the first book of the Bible, Genesis, chapter 49, so it's towards the end of the first book of your Bible. If you have a Bible, go ahead and open to that. If you don't have a Bible, we'll put the text on the screen. The first book of the Bible, Genesis, there are a few times where you start to get the sense that the people who are paying attention to God are waiting on someone. They're waiting on a special someone to come. And in Genesis 49, we have Jacob, of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jacob calling together his 12 sons. Boys, we're going to have a little family meeting. And in the 49th chapter, the first verse, it starts off him saying, I'm going to tell you about what's going to happen to you in the days to come. And it's kind of a metaphoric way of saying, this is how it's going to go for your lineage. This is how each of you are going to pass down your seed. This is what it's going to be like for each of you in 12 different directions. And so he talks to each son over their life, but over the legacy that line of people would leave. And so he starts, and some of it's really beautiful stuff, and some of it's like, oh, can you imagine your dad telling you that? Reuben, you're going to start off strong, and then you're going to be an epic failure. He gets to Zebulun. Zebulun, first, sorry about your name. It's a crazy year for your mom and I. We got into the Beatles, and we lived out of our truck. But they're going to love you in North Carolina. They're going to have a whole town. Barbecued pork. I know that's confusing my Jewish son, but then this to son Dan. Dan, you are going to be known for justice. Your people will be about justice, but then ultimately you're a viper at the side of the road, snapping at feet as they walk by. You're a snake in the ditch at the end of the day. Thanks, Dad. And he gets to Judah. Judah. And he says, you are strength, and you are strong, and you're what I'm talking about. You're going to do some some amazing things. And he says these very strong, powerful things over Judah and the people that will come from the line of Judah. And then in the 10th verse, he says this: "The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples." The scepter is not going to leave the people, Judah, until Shiloh comes. Now, this is the only time Shiloh comes up. Who's this Shiloh? Who is this person? And depending on the translation of Bible you use, some people they just go ahead and spell out the definition of what it looks like Shiloh means. It's two word pieces put together, and so some translations don't even put Shiloh. They put what they think it means. But the Hebrew term is Shiloh. It appears to be a proper noun until Shiloh comes. Well, there is plenty of evidence throughout history that way before the time of Christ, that people, rabbis, the Jews largely looked at this as one of the very first messianic prophecies. This was this early on in the Bible that a Messiah was going to come, and one of his nicknames would be Shiloh. Now, there's a few reasons for this. One of them is that in Hebrew, the word Mashiach, where we get our word Messiah, and Shiloh in Hebrew, if you add up the numeric equivalents of all the letters, that's the same number. And that's a big deal to the Jews because they assign a number value to all of their letters, and Messiah and Shiloh have the same numeric value. That was part of it. But you can read this in the Talmud, which was the Babylonian Talmud. It was written and compiled after the time of Christ, but it's all previous writings. It's in various Targums and other rabbinical writings. And when we found the Dead Sea Scrolls, it reinforced all that. That for really thousands of years, this text right here was one of the first times in the Bible that God made it clear that from Judah, from the Jews, somebody was coming. Shiloh, Messiah, salvation, was coming. Now, the scepter shall not depart from Judah. The scepter is a metaphor of a tribal identity. Your scepter was representative of your ability to call your own shots as a nation. It's the nationhood of Judah. It's their ability and their autonomy to carry out the way that they set up their justice system, to carry out capital punishment, to hear cases, and to control their own population. So it's the autonomy of Judah. Their scepter is their ability to do it. And this passage says, Messiah, Shiloh, he's coming, and he'll come just in time. He'll come before the Jews lose their autonomy. The Jews will have their own strength as a people when he comes. But why is somebody coming? Why does somebody need to come? Why does a Messiah, a Shiloh, a Christ, the Greek word for Messiah, why does he need to come? Why does there need to be somebody that comes to set things right? Why is this expectation already in place? We have to go back just a little further, all the way to the beginning of beginnings. Genesis chapter 1. Because in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was tohu vabohu, formless and void. It was chaos, wild and waste, or what those Hebrew terms mean. There was nothing to it. It was chaos. And darkness was over the surface of the deep, but the Spirit of God, the Ruach of God, brooded over, hovered over it. And he spoke into the darkness and said, "Let there be light." And he separated the light and the dark, and the dark he called night, and the light he called day. And he looked at it and said, "That is tov, that is good." The first day. And then he said, "Let's separate air and water. Let's create atmosphere and water." And so he separated sky above, water below. And he saw it, and he saw that it was good the second day. And then he said, "Let land appear. Let's do a totally different kind of geography. Let land come up through the water. So you have water and you have land and you have sky, you have light, you have dark. And let the land sprout vegetation. Let the whole world be covered with life. Life of unbelievable variety in color, in ability, in adaptability. Let the world be covered in life." And he saw it, and it was good. It was tov. The third day. On the fourth day, he says, "Let's be able to see through this atmosphere so that we can see the moon to govern the night and to help us with our seasons and our calendars. And let's see the sun for what it is, a source of light and heat that governs the affairs of the day. The sun and the moon, and let's see the stars and the vast array of the cosmos that this little project is hanging inside." He saw and said, "That's tov. That's good." Fourth day. And then he said, let the water be absolutely teeming with life. Let the water be full of variety and things they'll be discovering for thousands of years. In fact, may people never discover all of it. May it not just exist because I created, but may it possess the potential to replicate itself after its kind and adapt and move and be beautiful and be stunning. Let the water be full of life. And you know what? Let the sky be full of animals and beasts that know how to defy gravity, that capture the imagination and inspire awe, that they can take off from the land and actually soar through the atmosphere. And he looked at it and he said, oh, that's tov. The fifth day. And he said, let the land be full of life, animals that do everything from crawl on their belly to sprint and gallop on 10-foot tall legs. May they be colorful. May they be dull. May they be brilliant and inspire all kinds of research. May they be utterly stupid because their brain is so small. May they be everything in between. May the world be covered with animals of every size, shape, and variety. But at the end of the sixth day, he said, then I've got this other thing I want to do. I'm going to make this other one. It's made of all the same stuff. It looks similar to some of the other ones. It comes from the same stock. Really, if you're going to get really scientific, there doesn't look like there's a whole lot of differences, but this one's different. I'm going to put something of myself in this one. And in the image of God, he created them, male and female. He created human beings from the same stock, and he breathed his ruach into them, and we're different. We're different. Human beings made on the end of the sixth day. And he steps back and he doesn't just say, I'm finished. But he has an emotional response. He says, it is very good. It is tov meod. He was thrilled with it. Human beings living together in intimacy. Man and woman and the intimacy that comes from that. Any two human beings, the intimacy that was made to happen, the vulnerability and the trust and the shalom harmony. The people groups and this people groups, it wouldn't be an us and them, but it would be a we, no matter where we found ourselves, would be connected in shalom harmony. And then human beings and their God. Adam and Eve never prayed. They spoke. They were connected to their God in shalom harmony, what we were intended for. And then human beings in this amazing world that God created. There's connectivity in every direction, and God wanted that, and it's very good. And what I know is that what I'm saying right now isn't religious. Something in you tells you that this is true. We were made for something else other than what we're experiencing. Because then we get to Genesis chapter 3, and whether you think that this is a sacred metaphor or it's literally history, I'm not concerned with that. What you know is that it's true. Something happened. And God gave human beings the ability to choose, because you can't love and also be a puppet. It has to be real, so you have to have free will. You have to be able to choose it. And for whatever reason, man and woman said, it's not that we don't believe in God. We know there's a God. We just don't believe he's ultimately to be trusted. If we're going to have a life, we're going to have to do things ourselves. And they rebelled, and we broke it. We broke the connection between each other. Now, suddenly, two people who knew everything about each other are dressing themselves in fig leaves, because now I have to control what you see. The real me, the real story, will never do. Now I have to present and pretend. And we still do that. They go and they hide behind a tree from God because there's shame. He could never love us. And hide when we know he's near. We still do that. God said, because of what you've done, now the ground's going to produce thorns and thistles, and you're going to sweat, and it's not going to cooperate with you anymore. Shalom has been broken between people, individually, systemically. Shalom has been broken between people and God. Shalom has been broken between people and the world that has been made. Nothing is as it's supposed to be. And I'm not talking about religion, am I? We know this deep down. Yeah, there's this beautiful world that we live in, but it's stained, it's sick. It's like a good, healthy thing is desperately infected with a disease. It's like you get glimpses of this beauty sometimes, but it's like through greased glass. I can't clearly see it. And I ache for it. And we live in this paradox of a world that's beautiful, stained with evil. A great tov mi'od creation and everything that's in it. But it's broken. It's fractured. And there's darkness. We live in this paradox today. You watch the news. You read a magazine. You have the 15th argument with that person. You find out about corruption. And there's this good marred with evil. And something tells us it's not supposed to be that way. And so I want to talk specifically about Haiti. Because what has happened in Haiti is just the latest example of beauty marred by extreme darkness. There's questions that come with what's going on in Haiti, and I don't have all the answers. But just Wednesday, driving my daughters to school, my six-year-old asked a question that we're all asking. So, Daddy, did God do this? And I start trying to talk with the script going on in my mind. I want to give her what she can understand, and I want to tell her no more than what I believe, and I want to tell her it's okay with what I don't know. But really what I wanted to do is, hey, look, a bird. And so I said what I believe. No, Anna. I don't think he did. I don't think that God exists. I don't believe in a God that randomly lets men, women, and children and babies get crushed under rocks to teach us some kind of lesson, but doesn't tell us ahead of time what the lesson is. That's part of the hell. You have to figure out why he did it. No, Anna. God didn't do this. But then you come to a second, maybe deeper theological adult question. Is God punishing Haiti? Is that what this is? More than once in the past week, I have either read or heard somebody say that the Haitians deserved what happened. And I've heard, you've heard that before, different catastrophes. You've heard talking heads on TV try to tell you theologically that this they had this coming. And I want to humbly submit to you that just read the New Testament. In fact, don't. Just pick one gospel and read it front to back. And you'll have your answer. Because what we find is that God did punish sin. That's the cross. The cross isn't just our symbol to compare and contrast with other faiths. The cross is God saying, all my wrath, all the disappointment in what humanity did to what I created, all of that, you can't carry that. And so he put it on himself in the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus dying on the cross, crying out, why have you forsaken me? He experiencing the gap between man and God. He experienced that for us. That's the cross. God punished sin on the cross. Jesus' last words were, it's finished. Yeah, but that's just for Christians. Non-Christians, they don't get to enjoy that. So God still punishes them, but Christians have the cross, but non-Christians, they still have to experience wrath. So there was no Christians killed in Haiti. I'm not aware of that stat. No, that's not it either. That's not it either. The other questions that come up, and this isn't an idea for me, I've asked this question. How can there be a God if such bad things happen? You have your own words for that. You've asked that question. How can something so terrible happen? I mean, Haiti? I wouldn't wish this on anybody, but why not Cuba or Greenland? Haiti? If you're from one of those places, seriously, I don't mean disrespect, but Haiti? Can you think of a worse place that this could have happened in? Why Haiti? If there's a God, how can bad things like this happen? Because if there's a God, he must be of a higher moral fiber than me. So he must be good. How can there be a God, a good God, if these things happen? And I just want to submit to you that I've thought a lot about that. And I want to offer this to you. Where do we get our standard of good and evil if there isn't a God? The very metric that we use to say there mustn't be a God is the one he must have given us. Because if all we are is fancy monkeys, I'm just a bald ape. If that's all we are, then I don't mean to be crass, but think deeply about this. Compassion and care and the many tears that people in this room have cried in the past week, that's very detrimental to our species. When people die by the thousands, if all we are is bald apes, then we should celebrate that that means more food for us and less sexual competition for our particular family strain. But we don't, because we're different, because we're made in the image of a God and we're different. And the very standard by which we say, God, you have failed if you're there at all, is the one he put in our chest. He gave us the set of scales. He is the one that helps us understand the difference between good and evil. And I would submit to you that as you shake your fists to the heavens and say, how can there be a God if such a bad thing happens? What you're actually doing is giving the best evidence that there is a good God. Well, then why? I mean, that's just, it's my last question. Just why? And I don't know. It's way above my pay grade. I don't know. We can't know. I'm suspicious when answers are offered. Ultimately, we can't know. But I think it's that our world is broken. I think it's because of what Genesis 3 tells us. People in God, people in the world. It's all severed, fractured, broken, and shattered. See, a couple times I've heard people say, it's like Haiti is cursed. What if we're cursed too? What if it's actually a curse to live the kinds of lives that many of us have gotten used to living? Because it makes us think that we're in paradise, and then we don't know what to do when the real world shows up. That we are so insulated, generally speaking, from calamity and catastrophe and harm. Now, we've got some serious stories in here. When people have gone through some really difficult situations, we know that. But generally speaking, we're so insulated from things like this that when it happens, we don't know how to process it because we have come to believe that life is, the default is good. That everything's supposed to be good. And we've forgotten that the default, since Genesis 3, is set on needs renewed, needs redeemed, needs love, needs reconciliation. It's broken. We know this. Intuitively, we know this. We have a what ought to be metric in our head. We know something's broken. And so I don't want to be flippant about my response to some of this. And there's more questions. But Jesus comes and doesn't answer why. Christ comes and he doesn't answer why. Instead, we're left today asking this question, a very meaningful question. What are we going to do about it? You stare in the corner and try to figure out the why for the rest of your life, or you can say, I think the world might not be perfect. I think it's actually broken. I think it's set to be redeemed. So what am I going to do about it? And how will I live out my response to that question? In the year 6 or 7 AD, current era, King Herod, they called him the king of the Jews. He was kind of overseeing within the Roman Empire the affairs of the Jewish people. And he was a brutal man. He killed some of his wives. He killed his first son. Somebody in the Roman government actually said, "Whew, I'd rather be King Herod's pig than his son." That's actually documented outside the Bible. You can find that. A brutal man. When about 6 or 7, he died. And his son, Archelaus, took the throne. Now, the first king Jews, the Orthodox Jews, they couldn't stand. God is our king. What are you? It's a puppet king that Rome uses to get done what they want to and keep the Jews quiet. And then he dies, and then Archelaus comes in through a different mother, and he's so barely Jewish, they can't stand him. They reject him from day one, and so they oust him, and they take him, and they exile him. They kick him out off of his throne. And so for the first time in Jewish history, something happened. Because the Jews had been through exile, they had been in captivity, they had been owned and oppressed by different people through the ages, but they were always able to hang on to their identity. But for the first time in history, you can find all of this outside the Bible, for the first time in history, something happened. Archelaus was booted, and the Roman government put in a procurator named Coponius. I think his first name was Al. Coponius is not Jewish, and he's put in the throne, and immediately that day, the Sanhedrin, the Jewish leading authorities, the council that carries out judgments, they weren't able to do their job. Immediately, their ability to carry out capital punishment was restricted. Immediately, the affairs of the Jews were limited. They had lost their autonomy. In other words, it's a matter of historical record that in the year 6 or 7, the scepter was taken from Judah. And you can read outside the Bible in the Jewish history books of the day that this happened. The religious leaders, the Jewish religious leaders, they went out into the streets, tearing their garments, crying out with ashes on their head, this: "Woe unto us, for the scepter has departed from Judah and Moshiach has not come." It's written in the Babylonian Talmud. Woe to us, for the scepter has been taken from Judah and Messiah, Shiloh, hasn't come. This was a theological crisis. The word of God has failed. He said that he was going to send the one. The one that was going to, with his military cunning and his strength and his prowess, crush all the mean people and put Judah back in control of all things, and was going to put people in Eden so long as they had earned it. And he was going to come and do it. And he didn't come, and we have lost our autonomy. And where is he? And they're in the streets crying out with ashes on their head of grieving, and they've torn their robes. And on the other side of town somewhere is this young Jewish kid named Jesus. Yeshua. And I don't know what he was doing that day. Helping out his stepdad with carpentry. Maybe he was fishing. Maybe he was reading Genesis 49. Messiah had come. It's a matter of historical record. Shiloh came. And he didn't fit the expectations, because he didn't come with answers to why, and he didn't come to pull brokenness underneath his control. What he came to do is solve our worst problem, that we were disconnected from God, and that nothing within our capacity could mend that. So he did. He solved our worst problem, and then he said, "Follow me. If you're with me, if you want transformed, I will transform you, and then you will be an instrument of transformation. And we are going into the darkest recesses of this planet, and we are going to redeem it. My spirit in your hands and feet. Follow me. You are the light of the world." Who's with me? He doesn't come with answers to why. He says, "What are you going to do? Are you with me?" Someday he's going to come back, and someday it's going to get better. Someday God gets Eden back. I don't know when that is. For now, what are we going to do with the world that we actually live in? The world that the Bible warned us about, the world that we keep seeing, that keeps creeping in through the seams in our insulated bubble for some of us that we've forgotten. We live in a war zone, and our weapons are love, pouring out the self into a broken, fractured, dark place. That we're going to be about what God is about. So let's ask some questions. Let's ask questions about our life, because what we're not invited to do is be a people that respond to an event. This is about how we live our life. I don't mean this cynically, but media attention on what's going on in Haiti and whatever happens after that, it will wane. It will shift to the next thing, but we're different. We are people who recognize that the default is set on renew. It needs redeemed. It needs love. And that's why we live another way, because it's not about responding to an event. That's a good thing. But we live our lives differently because we recognize. We recognize that things are not as they ought to be. And we're going to follow Jesus. So let's ask questions. What does it look like for you to look at whatever you do for a living as a latent opportunity to be a light in a dark place? I mean, we're going to live our lives ignoring what the real world is like, pretending that we've already arrived, that we're in paradise, or will you look at what you do right now for a living as a chance to mend the fracture between any two people or any two people groups or any two, between the genders or between the races? Do you have even a small opportunity to bring light into a dark fracture between people? Does what you do for a living depend on the fracture? In other words, do you find that what you do for a living counts on brokenness for you to succeed? There's big questions that are going to come from that. How are you positioned right now to do something that's about mending people with each other, mending people with their God, mending people with a broken world? The way that we educate ourselves, what do you want to be when you grow up? What job do I want to have? Is the question all about what you'll earn, or is it simply about you? Or can you ask greater questions? I'm going to educate myself so that I'll be ready. I'll be ready to speak to whatever level of brokenness that I'm invited to step into and bring God's kingdom. How we take care of ourselves, asking questions about staying ready to help people, to enjoy life, but to also recognize that we are a people that are poised to be light of the world. We're doing a blood drive here at the end of this month, January 30th. How should I treat my body so that I'm ready to do even little things like that? Because my life is not about me. It's not about something small. I'm on a mission to follow Jesus as the light of the world into the darkness. Relational questions in your office, in your family, relational questions within your marriage or your singleness, all kinds of questions about how your organization pits itself against others and what you do to be part of redemption. Deep questions about how we live. So for the next couple minutes, let's just ask that. Let's begin asking that question. What does it look like to follow Jesus into the darkness with our light, with the light that we have? And we'll take our why question with us, but we'll ask, what am I going to do about it? How will I see myself as already positioned, if I'm willing to accept that, already positioned to be light in the world? Paul said it like this to the Romans. Don't be overcome by evil. Don't let evil steamroll you. Don't be overwhelmed or surprised by evil. Don't be shocked that evil and darkness creeps in. But instead, overcome evil with tov. You're part of what God is up to in the world. Overcome it with good.